Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we open our show with national headline stories from Public News Service, including new allegations of more sexual misconduct by Supreme Court nominee Justice Brett Kavanaugh and an update on the Violence Against Women Act in Congress. In local news, we'll have special reports today on what's at stake in the San Miguel Fire Board race and information on two slates of candidates squaring off in the La Mesa Spring Valley School District in the November election. Hear about SDG&E's firefighting air crane, which is now being stationed year-round in East County. And if you're concerned about power shutoffs and communications during emergencies, the California Public Utilities Commission will be holding a hearing in San Diego on Friday, and we'll have details. Also hear about a Marine who saved a woman from a burning car on a local freeway. Then on People Power, hear about a clothing drive at the El Cajon Library this Saturday to help the homeless. Hear why you'll need some extra postage if you're mailing in your ballot in the upcoming election. And on Destination East County, hear about all the top events coming up across our region from Oktoberfest to spooky Halloween happenings. On the second half of our show, we'll be re-airing one of our Best of East County episodes today, an interview with former Anza Borrego Desert State Park Superintendent Mark Jorgensen about his book on the most iconic species in our region, Peninsular Desert Bighorn Sheep. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
A second accuser emerges with misconduct allegations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. The New Yorker is reporting, as Senate Republicans press for a swift vote to confirm Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's nominee to the Supreme Court, Senate Democrats are now investigating a new allegation of sexual misconduct against Kavanaugh. According to The New Yorker, the claim dates back to the 1983-84 academic school year when Kavanaugh was a freshman at Yale University. They report the offices of at least four Democratic senators have received information about the allegation, and at least two have begun investigating it. The New Yorker adds senior Republican staffers also learned of the allegations last week in conversations with The New Yorker and expressed concern about the potential impact on Kavanaugh's nomination. Soon after, they report, Republicans issued renewed calls to accelerate the timing of the committee vote. And federal legislation that funds resources for victims of domestic and sexual violence is set to expire at the end of September. More from Eric Tegedoff.
Attorneys General, including Montana's Tim Fox, and groups across the country are urging Congress to renew the Violence Against Women Act. Agencies and organizations in Montana have received more than $70 million through the law since 2005. It's directed more than $6 billion nationwide since the bill was enacted in September 1994. Robin Turner is with the Montana Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence.
I really can't overstate the importance of the 1994 Violence Against Women Act. It was the first comprehensive federal legislation that was designed to end violence against women, to end gender-based violence.
And it includes a provision that closes the so-called boyfriend loophole by prohibiting dating partners under court protective orders from possessing firearms. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for starting your week, News and Cruisin' with Public News Service at publicnewsservice.org.
The stakes are high in the San Miguel Fire Protection District's election this November. A slate of three incumbents on the fire board voted to return the district to local control and cancel a contract with CAL FIRE, and now they are running for re-election. The district's firefighters are backing those three board members, Teresa McKenna, Jim Eck, and Mike Vacchio. Also in the race is William Keel, son of board member William Keel with the same name. The senior Keel voted against ending the contract with CAL FIRE when the board voted in July 2016 by a slim one-vote margin to return the district to local control and give CAL FIRE the boot. The contract terminated officially in July 2017. Since then, the district has improved its financial stability, according to Chief Brainard, who reported to the board that the district ended its fiscal year this July at $5.5 million under budget. All stations are open and staffed, with response times averaging 9 minutes, according to a recent presentation made to district homeowners. The outsourcing of firefighting to CAL FIRE was done due to a budget shortfall during the recession several years ago, when property tax revenues had fallen and a prior board had run up expenses building a training center it couldn't afford to finish. That forced closure of a fire station in Dehesa. CAL FIRE took over firefighting operations and reopened the closed station. But San Miguel's longtime firefighters complained of longer shifts and said public safety was compromised. A new board was elected on a promise to take back local control and lived up to that promise. On the San Miguel Firefighters Facebook page, this message is posted regarding McKenna, Eck, and Vacchio. Please help us in supporting those who brought local control and fiscal strength back to the citizens we serve. The fourth candidate in the race has drawn controversy. A lawsuit filed by McKenna accused Keel of trying to trick voters by failing to distinguish himself from his father with the same name. The court ordered the younger Keel to use his legal name on the ballot, William Keel II. A student with a business selling trading cards, he was also ordered to change his occupation on the ballot from businessman to entrepreneur and pay court costs. However, the court denied a request that would have forced Keel, who is 22 years old, to list his age on the ballot. The judge also ruled that his ballot statement can say he wants to put the district on sound financial footing, even though his opponents argue that it already is. Keel disputes claims by his opponents about the amount of budget surplus, but says the legal action hurt him financially, and he did not sue his opponents over the financial claims made in their ballot statements. As for the three candidates backed by the district's firefighters, McKenna is a retired fire captain in the district where she served for 22 years. Eck has also served as a fire captain, and Vacchio, a current fire captain in the district, is back on the job after suffering injuries battling the West Fire in Alpine. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Controversy has enveloped the La Mesa Spring Valley School Board, where three incumbents are stepping down, leaving three open seats. Now, two slates are battling for control of the board. One slate of three challengers has been critical of the board's actions. They're backed by Action Community for Educators and Students, a grassroots organization that formed to bring new direction to the board. The group is supporting two Democratic Party-endorsed candidates, Sharda Fonteno and Rebecca McRae, as well as one political independent, Jerry Lecco. Fonteno is an educator, parent, and entrepreneur who has served on the PTA and District Advisory Council and is endorsed by the Teachers Association. McRae is a teacher and parent. Lecco, a parent, architect, and businessman, previously served on the school board and chaired the Prop M Citizens Bond Oversight Committee. The Republican Party, which has long held all five seats on the board, has endorsed its own slate of candidates. Steve Babbitt, a businessman, parent, and pastor of the Spring Valley Church, as well as Brianna Garza, a parent businesswoman, and parent Megan Epperson. A seventh candidate, backed by neither slate, is Matthew Austin Sablove, an educator and businessman who has not provided a website with any information on his candidacy. A forum for La Mesa Spring Valley School District candidates will be held on Monday evening, October 1st, at the La Mesa First United Methodist Church, with a meet-and-greet at 6:15 p.m. and a forum at 6:30. Why are some community members organizing for change? Board President David Chong, a gun store owner, drew fire for statements slamming students concerned about gun violence on campuses after the mass shooting at a Florida high school. Chong says he is not seeking re-election because he is moving out of the area. Bob Duff, who has been on the board for 14 years, is retiring due to age. Rebecca Basson is also stepping down. A church secretary appointed to fill a vacancy, she brought criticism to the board for naming her over qualified candidates, including a PTA president and bond oversight committee member, as well as a former teachers union representative. Basson had no children in the district, attended mostly private schools, had no experience on any board, and was registered to vote in another state when she accepted what many viewed as a partisan appointment. She is now expecting, and says she's stepping down to focus on her family. While it's unclear yet which candidates will win in November, with three board members resigning, it's certain that there will be three new faces on the board. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
With wildfire now a year-round threat, San Diego Gas and Electric Company has announced that its air crane will be permanently stationed at Gillespie Field in El Cajon. In the past, the massive firefighting helicopter had only been available locally for 4 months a year. Due to extreme wildfire conditions, it has already responded to more wildfires this year than in all of 2017, according to SDG&E. The air crane is the largest water-dropping helicopter in the nation, capable of holding 2,650 gallons of water or fire suppressant, the amount carried by 5 fire engines. The craft can be maneuvered over a lake or pond where a large hose can suck up its water load in just 45 seconds, allowing the air crane to return to the fire zone quickly. SDG&E will report up-to-the-minute work of its crane via Twitter with the hashtag SkyMavericSDGE. Cal Fire and County Fire Authority Chief Tony Meekum called the SDG&E air crane a game-changer, adding, "To have this critical tool available to us during the early stages of a fire has already had a very real impact on fires this year." During a press conference on the air crane, SDG&E also indicated that fewer customers will now be impacted when power lines are shut off due to higher fire danger. The utility is installing portable generators operated by remote control to sectionalize electric circuits and reduce the number of customers impacted during a shutoff. Residents will also have access to evacuation centers equipped with water, snacks, Wi-Fi, and electronic device charging stations. These community resource centers will be open during extended power shutoffs lasting more than 24 hours. Locations will include Golden Acorn Casino in Campo, Camp Oliver Lodge in Descanso, Delzura Community Center, Hakumba Highland Community Church, Whispering Winds Catholic Camp in Julian, Lake Morena Community Church, Mountain Empire Unified School District Office, and Warner Springs Resource Center. SDG&E did not respond to questions on what the utility is doing to help residents with chronic health conditions dependent on medical devices during power outages. SDG has also launched a wildfire safety page. You can view around-the-clock weather information, live views of fire threat areas, and additional safety information at sdge.com/wildfire-safety. You can also access the utility's weather page staffed by SDG&E's 24-hour team of meteorologists at sdgeweather.com. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fisteer.
Power shutoffs during emergencies have been a burning issue across East County. On Friday, the California Public Utilities Commission will hold a public workshop in San Diego on emergency coordination and communication efforts by electric and water utilities with local and state government agencies and other stakeholders. The commission will also consider the need for new rules and regulations. Issues to be addressed at the workshop will include communication protocols with communities during emergencies, including the ability of utilities to reach communities in remote locations, rural areas, customers with medical needs, and other potentially hard-to-reach populations. That workshop will be held Friday from 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the San Diego County Operations Hearing Room, and that's located at 5520 Overland Avenue in San Diego. This is the second public workshop in the PUC's ongoing proceeding regarding water and electric utility emergency planning and disaster preparedness. All interested stakeholders are encouraged to attend and provide input on this important topic, including local government emergency planners, first responders, public works water and electrical engineers, and rural residents. No official action will be taken at the workshop, although the commissioners can consider input received at the workshop in future actions. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Marine Sergeant Gary Wilson saved a woman from a burning SUV on Tuesday after a multi-vehicle collision, also freeing a second driver from the wreckage. According to Officer Jake Sanchez with the California Highway Patrol, a white Freightliner truck was traveling south on State Route 163 just north of Highway 52 at a high rate of speed. The truck rear-ended a Toyota Highlander, pushing it into several other vehicles stopped in heavy traffic. The Highlander was pushed off the roadway and burst into flames. The Marine, who stopped to assist, saw the vehicle on fire and realized the driver was trapped in her vehicle. He broke the passenger side window with his elbow. Then, with help from a second Good Samaritan, the Marine pulled the woman, Poway resident Alexandria Garcia, to safety. The Highlander's driver was transported to Scripps La Jolla for treatment, as was the driver of a white Hyundai Sonata, who also suffered injuries. The other vehicles struck were a white Aurora and a red Jaguar. 10 News reports that Sergeant Wilson also helped a second motorist out of her vehicle. Sergeant Wilson told 10 News he was on his way to work on his motorcycle when he saw the accident. Officer Sanchez says, without the assistance of the Good Samaritans on scene, the outcome of this collision would have been much more tragic. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fisteer.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is Miriam Raftery with a People Power report. The forgotten clothes in your closet could help someone in your community. The El Cajon Library is partnering with the Street Store to hold a pop-up clothing store for the homeless on Saturday, September 29th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. With more than 10,000 people experiencing homelessness in San Diego County, clothing donations, especially those made ahead of the colder season, can make a big difference. The El Cajon Library encourages the community to clean out their closets and bring clothing items to the library on Saturday, where homeless men and women will be able to pick out what they need free of charge. Clothing must be clean, adult-sized, and in good condition. Started in South Africa, the Street Store is an international project that brings community members together to help in providing one of life's basic necessities. The idea is to encourage community interaction and provide an accepting and safe space for all. Clothing donations are only accepted on the day of the event, and again, that's this Saturday, September 29th, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the El Cajon Library. Anything left at the end of the day will be donated to charity.
Because of the large number of contests and initiatives in the November 6th gubernatorial general election, San Diego County registered voters will receive a two-card ballot. If you vote by mail, you'll need to put 71 cents in postage stamps on your ballot envelope because the ballot weighs more than usual. Contests will be listed on the front and back of each page. Considering the length of the ballot, the Registrar of Voters is urging voters to plan ahead and save time at the polls. One way is to vote by mail. You can sign up to be a permanent mail ballot voter at sdvote.com. More than 1.1 million mail ballots will go out to homes starting Monday, October 8th. Voters are urged to return mail-in ballots as soon as they've made their decisions to be sure it is received before the November 6th election. Voters interested in casting their ballots at their assigned poll on election day are encouraged to mark their selections on their sample ballot pamphlet before going to the poll to save time and help lines move faster. The polls will be open between 7 a.m. and 8 p.m. The location is listed on the back of your sample ballot and voter information pamphlet sent to your home. For more information, you can call 858-565-5800 or visit sdvote.com. That phone number is 858-565-5800. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fisteer.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region. Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Valerie Watts
and Jonathan Getz.
bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County.
Each week!
Today we've got lots of upcoming exciting events for you in East County,
including Oktoberfests in La Mesa and El Cajon, spooky campouts at Lake Jennings in Lakeside, and Lions, Tigers, and Bears in Alpine, a masquerade ball in El Cajon, the Pumpkin Express at the Campo Railway Depot, the Laguna Mountain Rendezvous, Borrego Days Desert Festival and Parade, Fair Trade Shopping in La Mesa, and Haunt Fest on Main in El Cajon.
So stay tuned for all of these events and many more. Strap on your lederhosen and get ready to bust out your best chicken dance and polka moves at the 45th Annual La Mesa Oktoberfest, September 28th through 30th in La Mesa's downtown village. Besides German cuisine and beer, the La Mesa Oktoberfest will also feature two stages of non-stop music, featuring everything from traditional Bavarian and German music, live oompa bands, traditional rock bands, DJ, cover pop, and more. You can also find homemade treasures, explore authentic art and German-style craft pieces from over 30 local artisans. Plus, there's a German Kinder Carnival, featuring a Ferris wheel, rock climbing wall, massive inflatable slides, interactive art, bratwurst eating competitions, scavenger hunts, and more. For more information and a schedule of entertainment, you can visit lamesaoktoberfest.org. Oktoberfest, O-K-T-O-B-E-R-F-E-S-T.
The German-American Societies of San Diego will host their own Oktoberfest at their headquarters in El Cajon the last weekend in September and first weekend in October on Friday nights, Saturdays, and Sundays. Guests can enjoy authentic German food such as bratwurst, ox roasted on a spit, potato salad, potato pancakes, sauerkraut, red cabbage, pretzels, and Bavarian pastries, and of course, German beers. Entertainment includes the Guggenbach Bomb Band, flown in all the way from Germany for your polka and oompa-pa pleasure. For advanced tickets and details, you can visit GermanClubsSanDiego.org.
Lake Jennings in Lakeside is hosting spooky Campoween events the two weekends before Halloween, October 19th through the 21st and October 26th through the 28th. Complete with ghost stories, s'mores, a campsite decorating contest, trick-or-treating, and creepy crafts. On Friday nights, get in the spirit with ghost stories and s'mores at 7 p.m. Then on Saturdays, there will be campsite trick-or-treating from 4 to 5 p.m., followed by a campsite decorating contest with judging at 6 p.m. Prizes include an all-inclusive camping weekend. On Sundays, you can also enjoy creepy craft time at 10 a.m., For more information, visit lakejennings.org.
A Night to Remember is a masquerade ball to benefit St. Madeline Sophie's Center. It will be held on September 28th from 7 p.m. to midnight at the Crystal Palace in El Cajon. This magical evening of festivities and excitement will include dinner and an open bar, a fashion show, a saxophone player and a violinist, plus a DJ to dance the night away. For tickets and reservations, you can visit Stephanie Young Consulting at syc.ticketleap.com.
You're invited to come ride the Pumpkin Express aboard vintage rail cars through the San Diego County mountains as fall descends upon Campo. Walk through a themed display building at the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum, complete with two haunted trains, a pumpkin patch, and a creepy cast of ghosts and ghouls. For details, visit the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum at psrm.org.
You are invited to step back in time to an 1800s-era Rocky Mountain fur trading camp at the 30th Annual Laguna Mountain Rendezvous, October 12th through 21st, at the Mataguay Scout Reservation in Santa Isabel. You can view demonstrations of survival skills such as tool-making, cooking, tomahawk throwing, archery, and black powder shooting. This event draws hundreds of participants from across the western U.S. Period campers and day visitors are also welcome. For more information, you can visit lagunamountainrendezvous.com.
You're invited to shop with joy and purpose at the annual La Mesa Fair Trade Shopping event on Sunday, October 14th from 8 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at St. Martin of Tours Parish Hall in La Mesa. Enjoy fair trade ice cream and food samples while perusing handmade baskets, jewelry, leather goods, clothing, toys, pottery, Christmas ornaments, gift baskets, coffee, tea, chocolate, and more. You can make a difference with your purchases this season by improving people's lives and the environment. The goal of the fair trade movement is to pay farmers and artisans in developing countries a fair price for their goods to help alleviate poverty around the world.
The 7th Annual Haunt Fest on Main is back on Friday, October 19th from 5 to 10 p.m. in the 200 block of East Main Street in downtown El Cajon. This fun, family-friendly, Halloween-themed community event features live music, costume contests, carnival rides and games, candy challenge activities, Monsters, Inc. and Monsters University outdoor movies, face painting, craft booths, inflatables, and more. For more information, you can visit hauntfest.org.
An air parade will sweep the skies with over 30 vintage and military aircraft as part of this year's parade in Borrego Springs on Saturday, October 20th at 10 a.m., followed by a 10:30 street parade complete with floats, equestrians, trick-riding cowboys, marching bands, and more. It's all part of the two-day 53rd Annual Borrego Days Festival, October 20th and 21st. Borrego Days also includes crafts and vendors, kids activities, including rock climbing, carnival rides, and inflatable slides, food and beverages, plus live music to dance the night away. For more information, you can visit borregodays.com.
Come for a wild and ghoulish night under the stars with the rescued exotic animals at Lions, Tigers, and Bears in Alpine on Friday night, October 26th through Saturday morning, October 27th. This annual spooky campover at the world-renowned nonprofit animal sanctuary is a family favorite. You can enjoy pumpkin carving, s'mores, campfire songs, special animal feedings, and more. A costume contest will be held Saturday morning, followed by a special feeding visit to watch the big cats and bears enjoy their pumpkin treats. Don't forget to bring camping gear, food, a pumpkin to carve, and of course, your best costume if you come. For tickets and details, you can visit lionstigersandbears.org.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more in the calendar and events section on our website, eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you'd like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around East County!
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's backcountry.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, people-powered radio, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. Today, my very special guest is Mark Jorgensen. Mark was the longtime supervisor of the Anza Borrego Desert State Park. He is a biologist, and he is now the author of a book on bighorn sheep called Desert Bighorn, Wilderness Icons. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me today.
So tell us a little bit about your background studying bighorn sheep through the years and how you got interested in this particular topic.
I started actually in my teens and visited Anza Borrego very often. I grew up in above El Cajon in Fletcher Hills. Took every opportunity I could to get out to the desert where I found a lot of freedom. Mm-hmm. And bighorn sheep just really grabbed my mind, and I was totally intrigued by an animal that could survive in such a harsh landscape.
Yeah, they are amazing, the way they can just scramble up a steep, rocky face and survive on so very little water in such a forbidding environment out there. And they're beautiful, beautiful creatures. So how many of these desert bighorn sheep do we have left today, and are they endangered?
In San Diego County now, we're at a very high level, probably higher than we've had in 40 or 50 years, we think.
Really?
Probably over 600 in mm-hmm. San Diego County. And the population that we study is called a peninsular bighorn in the peninsular mountains from Palm Springs to the Mexican border. Yep. And we feel there are probably about 1,000 bighorn in that group now.
Okay. And does that include, there are also some of these in northern Mexico, correct?
Correct. Baja California has quite a few distinct populations. One population now that we think is derived from a core population in Carrizo Gorge has now repopulated the area around Interstate 8 and Mountain Springs Grade, and we've documented through radio telemetry those animals crossing the border into northern Baja.
Very good news. So in the entire world, which basically the southwestern areas here and northern Mexico, how many peninsular bighorn are there on the planet?
Well, desert bighorn, which peninsular are a subspecies of, we estimate now there are about 31,000.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel that that's probably the highest population we've had throughout the southwest and northern Mexico in probably 75 or 80 years.
That's very good news. Now, how many of those are the peninsular subspecies that we have here in San Diego's East County, out in Borrego and so forth?
About 1,000 within the United States, and then probably another 1,000 of that.
So they
particular
really are,
group in Mexico.
Yeah, so there's only 2,000 of them. So even though the population has increased, would you say this is still something that we should be very concerned about, making sure we don't take missteps that could imperil these animals?
Exactly. We have an increasing population in 7 U.S. states and 6 states within Mexico. These animals, desert bighorn, were extinct in the state of Texas. They were extinct in 3 states in northern Mexico. Now, through a lot of very diligent efforts, they've been brought back.
Nice.
They've been transplanted. But we can never be really too cautious. We have to understand what caused them to go extinct in some of those areas in the first place and make sure those things don't happen again.
Right. So what are the biggest threats to the bighorn sheep locally here in San Diego and Imperial counties, as well as northern Mexico?
The biggest threat we have overall in the southwest has been diseases derived from domestic livestock.
Ah.
We don't have a lot of that in our local desert areas, although we do still have signs that we have some pneumonia problems that take out young animals especially. And we're seeing certain canyon areas, certain subpopulations that are really having trouble rearing their young through that first summer.
Is there anything that can be done to protect them from that?
We have been trying to work with interagency groups and with ranchers, livestock operators, to make sure that we have no domestic sheep and no domestic goats anywhere within bighorn sheep habitat.
Yeah.
Now, one issue about our animals crossing the border now into northern Baja is the lack of controls in Baja with livestock operators. So these animals that spend much of their time in California could cross the border, make contact with domestic sheep or goats, and turn around and bring those disease agents back to their herd mates back in California. And really, those things can spread very rapidly.
Right. Now, the border issue is kind of a double-edged sword, though, isn't it? Because on the one hand, they can get exposed to diseases down there. But on the other hand, they have historically crossed the border back and forth seasonally for water sources, maybe food sources. And how is the border wall? We hear a lot of talk these days, Donald Trump and others, about let's just wall off the entire border. A good portion of it already is here in San Diego County. How is that impacting the bighorn sheep here?
So far, we have held off the triple fence and the high walls within bighorn habitat in San Diego and Imperial County. We need to really monitor that situation. When you look at the entire border, Arizona, New Mexico, California, you have to be concerned about many large mammals that have been crossing that border for hundreds of thousands of years. Jaguar, pronghorn, and bighorn. And
can they get through or over the wall that we have out there in East County? It's not real big, or is it just a matter of only after it ends out there somewhere around Jacumba?
Correct. The fence currently ends at Jacumba Airport, just east of the small town of Jacumba. And then there is no fence through the rugged bighorn sheep terrain all the way to the desert floor.
Yeah, very rugged mountain areas, rocky mountains out there.
So we would like to see that status maintained where there is a large gap through the most rugged terrain. There are some human trafficking issues there, but it's not a main thoroughfare. it's not very welcoming to human foot traffic. Certainly vehicles can't make it through there at all.
Yeah.
The idea that some government officials just want a gigantic wall and without any consideration to hundreds of thousands of years of wildlife mm-hmm. corridors.
So do very many people really manage to get through that very, very rugged section? I mean, if they were to have their way, these officials, and wall that section off, obviously would have a huge negative impact on the sheep. Is it really doing much good in terms of, you know, keeping undocumented immigrants or whoever they're worried about from coming across the border there? Or is the terrain so rugged that it's pretty well accomplishing that on its own?
In my opinion, it's not worth it. They have double and triple fencing down along the Tijuana border from the ocean inland to Otay, and people still manage to climb that and go through it and under it.
Yeah, tunnels.
And now there's discussion about the Carrizo Railway being reopened.
Mm-hmm.
And so certainly you're going to have a causeway of movement of people and drugs through there.
Yeah. What about the drought that we've had for the last 5 years, which certainly is easing somewhat now, but how much of an impact has that had on the desert bighorn population, Mark?
All forms of wildlife are going to depend on good winter rains and good spring green-up mm-hmm. for the forage, whether you're talking about insects or reptiles or small birds. Certainly bighorn depend directly on spring vegetation green-up. And even though people thought this was an El Nino year, 2015 and 16, we still registered a little over half our average in Borrego Springs and in the desert region. So the drought is still in full swing. In order to have young survive, the females are going to have plentiful green up and nutrition in order to produce milk. And we have, you know, a significant number of lambs being born. Probably 80 to 90% of the females do give birth.
That's good.
But then we have very high mortality mm-hmm. rates in late spring, early summer.
Is that because of lack of water here or disease or other factors that we'll be getting into in a moment?
Yeah, it's very complex. So it's multiple factors. We can't just pin a very complex problem down to one or two simple solutions,
yeah.
But we do know that it works in combination.
Do predators take very many of the lambs, mountain lions, eagles, anything else, coyotes?
Mountain lions are the primary predator of bighorn sheep in our area. In the 1990s and early 2000s, we documented fairly common predation by mountain lions on bighorn sheep.
Mm-hmm. Which are protected now from hunting and shooting. So,
right. And you know, you'll have two sides of that controversy as well. People mm-hmm. that think mountain lions are in trouble and cannot be taken, and other people who think that if you took a great number of mountain lions, it would allow bighorn sheep to just spring back magically. Doesn't really work that way. We've seen high predation levels mm-hmm. suppressing bighorn sheep, and then when environmental factors reverse and we start getting more rain, more green up, we saw the sheep population rebound, and mm-hmm. and the mountain lion predation backed off quite a bit.
For centuries, the local desert bighorn sheep have had to contend with primarily natural cycles of drought and rainfall and predation and so forth, and then later the introduction of domestic sheep into their territory. But in recent years, we've also seen an influx of development of various types, everything from golf courses to, you know, resorts, and most recently these massive-scale green energy projects, the desert wind projects, industrial-scale wind projects and solar projects. What kind of impact are those projects having on the desert bighorn, and in your opinion, does that threaten their potential for survival over the long term?
It is a great potential threat, and it's a real threat in the big developments that have already been constructed. Many times these things are sited out in the desert, and I think society feels that put them out in the desert, they're out of sight, out of mind. And with government support, unfortunately, they've been put into some very valuable wildlife corridors.
So, yeah, I remember that you told us at one point about a report that the Anza Borrego Desert Park folks were trying to prepare that would be voicing concerns about the Ocotillo Wind Project when it was proposed, when there were hearings going on that the federal government was holding on that, and that wound up being suppressed. Did that report include concerns about the impact on the Bighorn Sheep of this wind project, which shared a 5-mile, or does share, it's been built now, a 5-mile border with the Anza Borrego Desert State Park?
Correct. And, you know, we've had state and federal government support of these mega industrial projects, whether solar panels or wind generation. And we have provided testimony at many of these meetings prior to construction, pleading with these organizations to consider wildlife concerns. And unfortunately, the government in large part has swept our concerns under the carpet. And in the case of the wind generator plant, when asked their opinions, the park folks unfortunately had to say they didn't have opinion. The government, state government, had told them to basically put a muzzle on it, and they didn't want state employees who really knew the situation on the ground countering what Governor Brown had approved.
Yeah, and the federal government, I think, shares some blame here, too. I know that they inexplicably delisted that entire project site and said it was no longer critical bighorn sheep habitat, even though everybody out there said you see bighorn all the time. It took our photographer exactly one day, when I asked him to go document bighorn sheep on the project site. He documented, I believe it was 11 of them, 11 or 12, standing there on the site. There was GPS on the photo, ear tags, tracking tags on these animals. Absolutely no question what they were, where they were, when this was taken. And when we sent this to the Secretary of the Interior, Salazar, his response was to order the issuance of take permits, allowing the wind developer to inadvertently kill up to 11 or 12 sheep, however many were actually shown in our photograph, rather than doing anything at all to protect them. And then after the project was approved and built, you know, despite all this evidence, people out there told us they quit seeing the sheep for a long time, and then when they dropped the big blade off and had to shut it down for 3 months, the sheep came back for a while and then left again when the project was powered back up. So it just seems like there's a lot of evidence, if they just open their eyes and look at it, to see that it's impacting, at the very least, the migratory ability of the sheep to move through this area, whether the actual noise or infrasound, you know, may also be impacting them, who knows.
And one of the towers was allowed, as you said, under a take permit to be placed right in a bighorn lambing area where we knew 6 bighorn females traditionally came to the same spot that they felt was safe.
Wow.
And so there was a take permit provided for 6 females and 6 lambs. And this is just not how our society should operate. When we are armed with good scientific information, we should step back a little bit. I mean, they started that project with over 200 wind turbines, and they ended up with 117.
Yeah.
So to go to 115 or 112 or whatever to accommodate bighorn lambing would have been really no net change for that operation.
Yeah, which is worth noting. It has underproduced ever since it was built. It has yet to ever meet its capacity factor that was promised all 3 years. It's come in substantially.
So what these projects do is you cut off bighorn movement here, you cut it off over there, and what that does is it fragments the bighorn habitat, where in prehistoric times we had free movement of animals from one mountain range across an open valley to another mountain range all the way into Baja. Now we have fragmented this into islands of habitat.
Yeah.
And we have Interstate 8, Interstate 10, wind farms. When these projects are allowed to be built within bighorn habitat, whether it's a border fence or a canal or a wind generator plant, one after another, whether it's a border fence or a highway or a canal or a golf course right up against, you know, into a canyon, these things preclude bighorn free movement, which they've had for hundreds of thousands of years. And it creates islands of habitat instead of an open, what we call a metapopulation, where animals can move in response to drought, disease, large-scale fires. Mm-hmm. They have a lot more resilience in a large swath of habitat.
Yeah, and I would think the islands could also contribute to inbreeding over time. I mean, you need a healthy population that's large enough to keep a healthy gene pool, right?
It could. We have studied that, and we found out that since rams do move long distances as far as 75 or 100 miles,
wow,
it doesn't take too many incursions by a ram to do away with that inbreeding concern. But in the long term, you've created these small islands of habitat, and they become much more vulnerable to whatever natural or human-caused catastrophe might beset that habitat.
Now, I've heard some talk about creating special wildlife overpasses on freeways. That's been done in some other countries. Tell us about that and whether that is something that could be helpful to our local bighorn population.
It definitely could, and we've been studying it for about 20 years, and it's about time that we took action on that. Interstate 8 is a prime example. We have animals crossing four lanes of traffic almost daily.
Wow, yeah, I've had readers send us photos of that pretty regularly.
And we've had quite a few animals get killed, and we know that it's happening. We have a water source adjacent to the highway, and as this population has expanded, which has been a good thing, the numbers have increased in that southern population from a group of about 30 back in the 70s and 80s to over 200 now. So that's all a good thing, but that means that you have to provide this historic habitat, you know, in high-quality fashion.
Yeah.
And I-8 was widened in 1963. During construction, there were bighorns seen every day, and for about 30 or 40 years, they were absent from there.
Wow.
Now they're back. They're getting hit by vehicles. There's probably, you know, many tens of thousands of vehicles a day.
So what would it take to get one of these wildlife bridges built?
The state of Arizona built three over on Highway 93 between Kingman, Arizona and Hoover Dam. They've been extremely successful. In the first 20 months of operation, they documented more than 2,000 crossings by bighorn sheep. So these things are, it's a matter of government action. And so these wildlife overpasses, really, the science is out on them. We don't need to study it anymore. We need to find out where to build them, and we need government funding. We need the initiative. We need some action to allow these bighorn free movement between these islands of habitat without being struck and killed. It'll also benefit public safety because a 220-pound ram,
yeah,
coming through your windshield,
not what you
is a threat to human safety. And so in Arizona, they've completely eliminated motor vehicle accidents with bighorn. We've had thousands of sheep crossings documented with cameras. Very successful.
Wonderful program. Well, let's hope they can get that going here. A couple of more questions. What are some of the most interesting facts about bighorn that you would like to share with our listeners that you have learned in the course of your many years of research, as well as your wonderful book about the desert bighorn?
Yeah, we put the book together, Desert Bighorn Sheep Wilderness Icon, Jeff Young being the photographer.
And it's beautiful photography, by the way. I highly recommend this book. It's published by Sunbelt Publishing right here in East County, and the photography is just stunning.
We had that difficult challenge of selecting from more than 60,000 photos that Jeff Young had taken, and we put 200 of them in this coffee table book. Our big goal there was to help educate the general public. I think people are fascinated to know that desert bighorn sheep still thrive in San Diego County, mm-hmm, right here where we all live in our backcountry, and they're thriving throughout the Southwest and into Mexico. But our goal was to help people learn more about this valuable wildlife species. And when we hear about potential threats or developments out in the desert, my goal is to develop a higher level of awareness and education among the citizens of San Diego County. So when they hear about a development going in, they can express their concern. And I think once you look at the book and read it, go out and see bighorn, I feel we all have an obligation to sound the alarms when we hear that something threatens this valuable wildlife species.
So what can people do specifically? Are there particular actions that you recommend the public take if they are concerned about preserving our local bighorn sheep?
I think when they hear about projects, whether it's more solar, whether it's Sunrise Power Link expanding, we hear about golf courses around Palm Springs, La Quinta, that are being notified they have to build fences to exclude bighorn. Border fence, anytime you hear that, the reentry of the Carrizo Railroad into Carrizo Gorge, bighorn will die. There hadn't been a train there in 34 years, and they actually used the tunnels for shade.
Oh, my goodness.
And while the train was operational, I went in and recovered two bighorn that had been hit by the trains. Mm. We know it's going to cause mortalities. So I would just ask the general public to call their legislators, county board of supervisors, and especially if you hear about another large-scale energy project out in the desert, to voice your concerns, come to public meetings, support groups that are doing the right thing, land acquisition, research projects, and we have the Anza Borrego Foundation that supports acquisition of bighorn habitat in
right.
Eastern County.
It's also a good idea, isn't it, to reach out to state and federal representatives, your members of Congress, your members of the state legislature, because so many of those decisions about the desert lands are out of the hands of the local supervisors. The railway, maybe they have a say-so over, but not if it's on, say, Bureau of Land Management land or some of these other places that have been impacted by the big projects.
I saw a piece on the local news, TV, about the railroad the other day, and I've been following it. I've written stories about it. I've researched it. It is not a moneymaker. It's almost impossible to keep it operational mm-hmm. because of fires, earthquakes, floods, natural disasters, the economy. And all I heard is this is going to be great for international trade between the U.S. and Mexico,
yeah.
and it's going to be a jobs creator. I didn't hear one word about the environment. You know, I'm not going to go out and make a big deal out of it. It's a dedicated railroad, and just let the chips fall where they will. But I predict it won't last 5 years, and it's not a good thing for the desert wilderness or for bighorn sheep. And I think that someone, when they come up with these big ideas, they should consider the environment once in a while.
Yeah, definitely. Just because it sounds green doesn't necessarily mean that it is, with the case of some of these big solar and wind projects and transportation and elsewhere. Now, the public can participate in the annual Desert Bighorn Sheep Count each year. It's in July. It's not for the faint at heart, but tell us about that.
We have been conducting an annual 4th of July Bighorn Sheep Count in Anza Borrego since 1971. And we generally solicit volunteers, mm-hmm. between 60 and 70 of them. And the difficult part for volunteers is they are assigned to a water source that is visited by bighorn sheep, at least we hope is. And they sit there for 3 full days in the shade, a couple hundred yards back from the water.
Yeah, and we might be talking shade when it's 110
it's quite grueling.
Or 115 degrees out there.
Some days they're lucky and it's only 103 or 105. Other days it's 118. So it is not for the faint of heart. And we have a mandatory orientation program.
Mm-hmm. So people want to get involved despite the hardships. You do get spectacular photos if you're a photographer out there. How do they sign up?
They can get ready for the summer of 2017 by sending their name, address, and their email and phone number out to Anza Borrego Desert State Park in Borrego Springs. Attention, Ranger Steve Beer, and he will put those potential volunteers on a mailing list. And next spring, he will notify them all of when the count and the mandatory orientation program would be. And they can get involved. We've had people, one individual's been on 44 out of the 45 we've had. Many people have been on 20 or 30 of them in a row.
My goodness. Is there a fascinating fact or two about bighorn sheep you'd like to share with our listeners before we wrap this interview up?
You know, through the use of technology, we have gained a lot of knowledge in the last 20 years. And today we have not only radio telemetry collars, but we've moved on to GPS collars and actually satellite collars that send info directly to a computer. So we've been shocked to see if some of the long-range movements, especially among the rams. We had one ram that we put a radio collar on down in Carrizo Gorge below the railroad, and he went missing. We searched for him with radio receivers, and we were astounded to find him 75 miles away in the Santa Rosa Mountains.
Wow.
All the way at the north end of the park. He'd gone through about five different mountain ranges, crossed about three or four paved highways.
He really got around.
And during the mating season, they go on these walkabouts in search of females.
Fascinating.
It drove home the idea that we need to keep these mountain ranges connected.
Yeah. What can you tell us about the relationships between our local Native American tribes and the bighorn sheep through the years?
We know through interviews with tribal elders and with a lot of the traditions that are carried on today that the desert bighorn played a very large role in the everyday life of both the Kumeyaay and the Kuya, who were native to San Diego County. We also have found several sites where bighorn were hunted by Native Americans. We find series of rock hunting blinds. So we know they were an important food source. They were also very important, you know, in the spiritual life of Native Americans.
Use the horns and everything.
Yeah. So, you know, and they continue to be valuable to not only the Native American groups, but to people in our society today. We have a lot of folks who gain strength just knowing that wild bighorn are out in the wilderness.
Yeah.
And also folks that want to go out. I just met a guy this morning. Had breakfast with him, and he was going out to photograph bighorn again.
Yeah, they're very inspiring. It's such a thrill to see one in the wild.
So we put the name Wilderness Icon in our book because these things truly are a symbol of wild places. They live in pure wilderness and in wild lands, and we would like to be able to nurture those wild habitats throughout America and Mexico.
Well, Mark, it has been such a pleasure having you here. Listeners, if you just tuned in, we've been speaking with Mark Jorgensen, who is the former supervisor of the Anza Borrego Desert State Park, a biologist, and the author of a wonderful new book called Desert Bighorn Wilderness Icon. You can get that through Sunbelt Publishing right here in East County. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you, and thank you for everything you do to preserve our environment here in San Diego County.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.